see a person who doesn't feel a whole lot different than he does at 50. And if reprogramming works, won't look a lot different either. I imagine walking into my lab at Harvard, much as I do these days most mornings of the week, to be bombarded by the energy and optimism of a motley group of researchers working to make discoveries aimed at changing billions of people's lives for the better. I absolutely love the idea of applying 60 or 70 years of experience to the task of leading and mentoring other scientists. Yes, it's true. When people choose to keep working for 80, 90, or 100 years, it will fundamentally change the way our economy works. Trillions of dollars have been hidden away in virtual and quite a few literal mattresses by people dreading the prospect of running out of money at a time in their lives in which they are too frail to return to work. The option to work at any age, if and when work is wanted and needed, will offer a sort of freedom that would have been unfathomable just a few years ago. The risk of spending one's savings on fulfilling a dream, innovating, starting a business, or going on a new educational journey will not be such a risk at all. It will simply be an investment in a long and fulfilling life. And it's an investment that will pay off in other ways too. Unleashing the Army. Dana Goldman had heard from all the naysayers. The University of Southern California economist understood, far more than most people do, that healthcare costs had risen dramatically over the past decades, not just in his native United States, but around the world. He knew that those costs were coming at a time in which human lifespans were being extended, resulting in multitudes of patients who were sicker for longer. And he was fully aware of the never-ending nightmare about the future solvency of programs such as Social Security that provide for the common welfare. The prospect of billions of people growing even older seemed like a perfect storm of economic catastrophes. A few years back, however, Goldman began to realize that there was a difference between extending lives and extending healthy lives. As it stands, aging presents a double economic whammy, because adults who get sick stop making money and contributing to society at the same time they start costing a whole lot to keep alive. But what if older people could work longer? What if they were to use fewer healthcare resources? What if they were able to continue to give back to society through volunteering, mentorship, and other forms of service? Perhaps, just perhaps, the value of those extra healthy years would lessen the economic blow. So Goldman began to crunch the numbers. As any good economist would, he sought to be both rigorous and conservative in his estimation of the benefits of delayed aging. He and his colleagues developed four different scenarios: one that simply projected spending and savings under the status quo conditions, two that estimated the impact of modest improvements to delaying specific diseases, and one that evaluated the economic benefits of delaying aging and thus reducing all the symptoms of aging. For each scenario, the researchers ran a simulation 50 times and averaged the outcomes. When Goldman reviewed the data, something became clear. Reducing the burden of any one disease, even several, wouldn't change much. Making progress against one disease means that another will eventually emerge in its place, his team reported in Perspectives in Medicine. However, evidence suggests that if aging is delayed, all fatal and disabling disease risks would be lowered simultaneously. For the record, that's precisely what I'm suggesting will happen to the total disease burden as long as we slow and even reverse aging. The result will be an upgrade of the healthcare system as we know it. Treatments that once cost hundreds of thousands of dollars could be rendered obsolete by pills eventually costing pennies to make. People will spend the last days of their lives at home with their families instead of racking up huge bills in centers intended for nothing more than aging in place. The idea that we once spent trillions of dollars trying to eke out a few more weeks of life from people who were already teetering on the edge of death will be anathema. The peace dividend we will receive from ending our long war on individual diseases will be huge. Over 50 years, Goldman estimated, the potential economic benefits of delayed aging would add up to more than $7 trillion in the United States alone. And that's a conservative estimate, based on modest improvements in the percentages of older people living without a disease or disability. Whatever the dollar figure, though, the benefits would accrue rapidly, Goldman's team wrote, and would extend to all future generations. Because once you know how to treat aging, that knowledge isn't going away. Even if we reinvest only a small amount of that dividend into research, we'll enter a new golden era of discovery. That discovery will be hypercharged as we unleash a vast army of brilliant people, not only to continue the fight to prolong human vitality, but to combat the many other challenges we currently face, such as global warming, the rise of infectious diseases, moving to clean energy, increasing access to quality education, providing food security, and preventing extinctions. Those are challenges we cannot effectively fight in a world in which we spend tens of trillions of dollars each year battling age-related diseases one by one. Even now, while we spend so much of our intellectual capital on whack-a-mole medicine, there are thousands of labs around the world with millions of researchers. That sounds like a lot, but globally, researchers account for just 0.1% of the population. How much faster would science move if we could unleash even a small bit of the physical and intellectual capital that's tied up in hospitals and clinics treating diseases one at a time? This army could be augmented by billions of additional women if they can be provided much longer windows of opportunity for pregnancy and parenting. Animal studies in my lab indicate that the window of female fertility could be extended by up to a decade. This is an exciting prospect because, in the United States, 43% of women step away from their careers for a period of time, almost always to shoulder the burden of child-rearing. Many never return to work. As a woman's lifespan and fertility lengthens, the consequences of taking a break will be seen as relatively minor. By this century's end, we will almost certainly look back with sadness at the world we currently inhabit, in which so many people, particularly women, are forced to choose between parenting and career success. Now add to the ranks of this army the combined intellectual power of the men and women who are currently sidelined due to age discrimination, socially enforced ideas about the right time to retire, and diseases that rob them of the physical and intellectual capacity to engage as they once did. Many people in their 70s and 80s will re-enter the workforce to do something they've always wanted to do, earning more than they ever did, or serving their communities as volunteers and helping raise their grandkids, as my father has. With the money saved by preventing expensive medical care, a retraining fellowship could be provided for a few years to allow people over 70 to go back to school and start the career they always wished they'd started but didn't because they made the wrong decisions or life simply got in the way. With active people over 70 still in the workforce, imagine the experiences that could be shared, the institutional knowledge that could be relied upon, and the wise leadership that would emerge. Problems that seem insurmountable today will look very different when met by the tremendous economic and intellectual resources offered by prolonged human vitality. That could be especially true if we're all engaging in our world with the best versions of ourselves. The greatest of these. In the early 1970s, two psychologists decided to put the parable of the Good Samaritan to the test. The biblical story, as you might recall, centers around the moral obligation to help those in need, and the psychologists figured that people who had the parable on their minds would be more likely to stop to help someone in distress. So they hired an actor to pretend to be in pain and put the young man, who was doubled over and coughing, into an alley next to the doorway of the Green Hall Annex at Princeton Theological Seminary. The psychologists had also recruited 40 seminary students to present a talk at the annex. First, though, the students were asked to stop by another building on campus. Once there, some of the seminarians were told they could take their time getting to the annex. Others were told they would be on time as long as they left immediately, and a final group was told they needed to hurry to make it to the annex on time. Just 10% of those in the high hurry group stopped to help the man. Those were the seminary students, for goodness sake, and they ignored a brother in need. One literally stepped over the man in distress to get where he was supposed to be. In the low hurry group, though, more than 60% stopped to help. In that experiment, the difference between whether a person made a compassionate choice had nothing to do with personal morality or religious scholarship, but whether he felt rushed. This isn't a new idea, of course. Back in the days in which Christ was first telling the Good Samaritan story, his contemporary in ancient Rome, Seneca the philosopher, was begging his followers to stop and smell the roses. Life is very short and anxious for those who forget the past, neglect the present, and fear the future, he wrote. For people who don't appreciate life, time is reckoned very cheap, in fact without any value, he lamented. These people do not know how precious time is. This might be the least considered societal advantage of prolonged vitality, and it might just be the greatest advantage of all. Perhaps when we're not all so afraid of the ticking clock, we'll slow down, we'll take a breath, we'll be stoic Samaritans. I would like to emphasize the word perhaps here. I will be the first to say that this thesis is supposition more than science. But the small sample Princeton experiment both followed and portended a lot of other research demonstrating that humans are a lot more humane when they've got more time. All of the studies, though, take stock of how people behave when they have a few more minutes or perhaps a few more hours to spare. What would happen if we had a few more years, a few more decades, a few more centuries? Maybe we would do nothing differently, even if we had 200 or 300 years. In the grand scheme of the universe, after all, 300 years is nothing. My first 50 years went by like a blink, and I suspect that 1,000 years, a mere 20 blinks, would also feel short. And so it comes down to this. When those years do come, how do we wish to spend them? Will we follow the perilous path that ultimately leads to a dystopian doom? Will we band together to create a world that exceeds our wildest utopian dreams? The decisions we make right now will determine which of those futures we create. And this is important. Preventing disease and disability is possibly the single most impactful thing we can do to avert a global crisis precipitated by climate change, crippling economic burdens, and future social upheavals. We have to get this right, because there has been no more consequential choice in the history of our species. So there's a turning point in the book. It happened in this chapter where we stopped talking specifically about the science and we start talking about its implications.
Yeah, and I think I sort of talked you into these chapters a bit, but I'm really glad you did this because I think the implications of what you're doing, of what researchers around the world are working toward together, are really pretty profound. I mean, what we're talking about, David, is like sort of a fundamental redefinition of what it means to be a human.
It is, in the same way that we're not the same humans that we were 200 years ago when we would all die from a cut finger. But our species is on an upward trajectory. As long as there's no major disaster, we'll continue to innovate. We'll continue to become the species that I think we're capable of being. And when people say, oh, that's unnatural, you know, you got to ask yourself, what is it about us that's natural anymore anyway? And so we really should be working towards making life better and happier and freer. And I think, at least as Americans, we can all agree that those are the things that we should strive for.
You just use the words upward trajectory, and you get dinged sometimes for being so optimistic. I know a lot of people in academia don't like that very much. Is it hurtful to you when people use your optimism as a punchline, like it's not okay for serious scientists to be optimistic?
Well, yeah, I'm often asked how long will people live? And, you know, I usually say best case scenario, this could happen. We could have somebody born today that could live into the mid to late 22nd century. There's nothing that says that couldn't happen. In fact, I've seen results more than most people have. So I have a better view of what the future looks like. But I do have colleagues who say, don't say those things. Don't say we're going to live longer. It's just not a good look. I think that's, first of all, I'm a scientist. I should be allowed to say whatever I believe in, right? It's a free world, and the last people you want to censor are scientists. But also, what's wrong with some optimism? And I'm not saying we're all going to live 150 years, but I am saying it's possible that somebody could.
Can I be that somebody?
Well, yeah, I would say you've got a front row seat. 9. A path forward. In 1908, only 5 years after the Wright brothers began flying, H.G. Wells published a book titled A War in the Air, in which Germany starts an air war against Great Britain, France, and the United States. To say Wells had a penchant for prescience would be a vast understatement. In 1914, the Institute of International Law tried to ban the dropping of bombs from flying machines, but it was too little, too late. Giant German Gotha planes began bombing Great Britain in 1917. That year, 180 miles west of London, a baby was born named Arthur, who would come to be regarded as the preeminent science fiction writer of the 20th century. As he became more famous, Arthur C. Clarke increasingly regarded predicting the future a discouraging, hazardous occupation. That may be true, but Clarke was awfully good at it, anticipating satellites, home computers, email, the internet, Google, live streaming TV, Skype, and smartwatches. Clarke had some strong opinions about scientists. A physicist in his 30s was already too old to be useful. In other scientific disciplines, a 40-year-old has likely experienced senile decay, and scientists of over 50 are good for nothing but board meetings and should at all costs be kept out of the laboratory. Toward the end of his life, Clarke gave a series of interviews. Most of them were recorded and edited because he had halting speech caused by post-polio syndrome. In one interview, he revealed that he had a use for washed-up scientists. When a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he's very probably wrong. I'm a scientist who is now 50. Some people might call me distinguished, and my students definitely don't want me in the laboratory. So although I can't say I'm certain about my predictions, I'm apparently well qualified to make them. I've been asked on occasion by members of the US Congress and the like for predictions of technological breakthroughs and how they might be used for good or evil purposes. A few years ago, I gave an opinion on the top 5 future advances in the biological sciences that would be of relevance to national security. Though I can't reveal what I said, I expect that most people would have thought that that was science fiction. My best estimate was that they would happen sometime before 2030. Within 6 months, 2 of them became science fact. I don't know precisely when the first individual to cross the threshold of 125 years will be, but he or she will certainly be an outlier, as pioneers always are. In just a few years, he or she will be joined by another, then dozens more, then hundreds. Then the fact won't be worth noting. Even longer lifespans will become more and more common. The world may see the first sesquicentenarian sometime in the 22nd century. If you think that's far off, consider that some researchers believe half of all American children born today will celebrate New Year's Eve 2120. Not outliers, half. Those who think all this is impossible are ignorant of the science, or they are denying it. Either way, they are almost certainly wrong. And because things are moving so fast, many of them might even live to realize they are wrong. No biological law says there is a limit to how long we can live. There is no scientific mandate that the average age at death must be 80 years. And there is no God-given mandate to die after 80 years. Indeed, in Genesis 35:28, Isaac is claimed to have lived 80. Thanks to the technologies I've described, a prolonged, healthier human lifespan is inevitable. How and when we'll achieve this is a bit less certain, although the general path is quite clear. The evidence of the effectiveness of AMPK activators, TOR inhibitors, and sirtuin activators is deep and wide. on top of what we already know about metformin, NAD boosters, rapalogs, and senolytics, every day the odds increase that even more effective molecule or gene therapy will be discovered as brilliant researchers around the world join the global fight to treat aging, the mother of all diseases. All of that comes on top of the other innovations that are on track to further lengthen our lives and strengthen our health, such as senolytics and cellular reprogramming. Add to that the power of truly personalized care to keep our bodies running, prevent disease, and get ahead of problems that could be troublesome down the road. That's not to mention the very easy steps we can all take right now to engage our longevity genes in ways that will provide us with more good years. With significantly prolonged vitality an inexorable part of our future world, what do you want that world to look like? Are you comfortable with a future in which the rich live much longer than the poor, and in doing so get richer with every passing year? Do you want to live in a world in which an ever-increasing population greedily scraps for every last remaining resource, while the world continues to be less and less habitable? If so, there's nothing left for you to do. The status quo will get us there, regardless, in fact, of whether we prolong human life or not. You can sit back, relax, and watch the world burn. There is another potential future, though, one in which prolonged youthfulness is the torch that lights the way to greater universal prosperity, sustainability, and human decency. This is a future in which tremendous resources are freed from a medical industrial complex that is based on battling diseases one by one, thus creating tremendous opportunities to tackle other challenges. It is a future in which people who have lived on this planet for a long time are revered for their knowledge and skills. It is a future of global good Samaritanism. It is also a future for which we must fight, for it is in no way guaranteed. To get there, we have some work to do. Invest public money to tackle aging now. I am a serial entrepreneur, a disciple of innovation, and a grateful beneficiary of people's investment in me and the teams I brought together to solve hard problems. I also recognize, however, that the free market doesn't magically produce good science or equitable outcomes when it comes to healthcare. In any research endeavor, a balance of public and private funding is vital to producing the conditions that encourage unbound scientific exploration, the investment in early discoveries, and a degree of common ownership that better ensures the benefits of newfound knowledge will become available to the greatest possible number of people. That balance has become even more precarious in recent years. Starting in 2017, for the first time since World War II, the US federal government was no longer the majority source of funding for basic scientific research in the United States. Federal funding for science in the United States began in the 1880s, when the Marine Hospital Service, the predecessor of the National Institutes of Health, was charged by Congress with examining passengers on arriving ships for clinical signs of infectious diseases such as cholera. In 1901, a routine Supplemental Appropriations Act providing $35,000 for a new building became the founding legislation of the NIH. Congress was not convinced that the money would go to good use, so it ensured that every year funding would be at the discretion of Congress. And so it remains. Hopefully, Congress remains convinced that NIH funding, which provides hundreds of competitive grants to scientists around the country, is money well spent. Because without NIH-funded research, the majority of medicines and medical technologies we rely on would never have been discovered, not to mention the thousands of new medicines still waiting to be discovered. At least for now, the federal government still makes up a large share of total funding for medical research at hospitals and universities, ensuring that R&D isn't driven by profit alone. This is important, so scientists like me can run with their imaginations and instinct, sometimes for a decade, before any commercial applications are apparent, and long before any investor would consider supporting the work to help it survive the innovation valley of death. Clearly, government is essential in this ecosystem, but in a world in which there is more competition for overall research funding than ever before, good scientists investigating aging are having to seek more and more private financial support for their work. world-changing research certainly isn't cheap, and when it's funded by a company with short-term goals, it isn't free either. That's why it's important that we reverse the decline in public funding for medical research, which fell by 11% in real dollars from 2003 to 2018. The situation is particularly hard for researchers studying aging. Funding to understand the biology of aging gets less than 1% of the total US medical research budget. With an aging population and ever-increasing healthcare costs, why aren't governments dramatically increasing funding for aging research to keep people healthier for longer? The reason is, in nearly every nation in the world that has made a civic investment in medical research, that research is tied back, if not completely tied up, by the definition of disease. If you are a scientist with an idea for a novel way to slow the progression of cancer, or a researcher with an inventive idea for ending Alzheimer's disease, the NIH and similar national research funding agencies around the world are there to help. The NIH isn't simply a bunch of buildings in Bethesda, Maryland. It allocates more than 80% of its budget to almost 50,000 competitive grants, to about 300,000 researchers at more than 2,500 universities and research institutions. Medical research would almost grind to a halt without that money. It's worth drilling down into the NIH budget to see which of the 285 diseases that are being researched get the most attention. Heart disease gets $1.7 billion for a disease that affects 11.7% of the population. Cancer gets $6.3 billion to impact 8.7%. Alzheimer's disease gets $3 billion for a disease that impacts 3% at most. How much does obesity, which affects 30% of the population and reduces lifespan by over a decade, get? Less than $1 billion. Don't get me wrong. Compared to how the government spends a lot of its money, the cost of a single F-22 Raptor fighter jet is upward of $335 million, for instance. This is all money well spent. To put it into even greater perspective, though, consider this. US consumers spend more than $300 billion per year on coffee. To be fair, life without coffee might not be worth living. But if you are a researcher who wants to make life even better by slowing or reversing diseases of aging, you have a bit of a problem. There just isn't that much public money being spent on that area of science. In 2018, Congress appropriated $3.5 billion for research into aging. But if you were to dig into the budgetary documents, you'd see that the money went almost entirely to research Alzheimer's disease, perform clinical trials of hormone replacement therapy, and study the lives of the elderly. Less than 3% of the funding for aging research was actually for the study of the biology of aging. Aging disables 93% of people over the age of 50. But in 2018, the NIH spent on aging less than a tenth of what was spent on cancer research. One scientist who is particularly annoyed by the budgetary focus on individual diseases is Leonard Hayflick, the scientist who first discovered that human cells in a dish have a limited capacity to divide and eventually senesce, after having reached the Hayflick limit. The resolution of Alzheimer's disease as a cause of death will add about 19 days onto human life expectancy, he noted in 2016. Hayflick has suggested that the name of the National Institute on Aging, a division of the NIH, might as well be changed to the National Institute on Alzheimer's Disease. Not that I support ending research on Alzheimer's disease, I do not, he said. But the study of Alzheimer's disease and even its resolution will tell us nothing about the fundamental biology of aging. The relatively tiny amount the United States spends on research into aging, however, is generous when compared to that of most other advanced nations, which invest next to nothing. There is no doubt that this situation is a direct result of the establishment view that aging is an inevitable part of life, rather than what it actually is, a disease that kills about 90% of the population. Aging is a disease. This is so clear that it seems almost insane that those four words need to be repeated again and again. But I'll do so anyway. Aging is a disease. And not only is it a disease, but it is the mother of all diseases, the one we all suffer from. Paradoxically, no public funding agency around the world classifies aging as a disease. Why? Because if we are fortunate to live long enough, we all suffer from it. And thus, for now, the pool of public funding available for research aimed at prolonged vitality is rather paltry. The biggest checks are still being written to support initiatives aimed at recognized diseases. And at the moment I am writing these words, aging isn't recognized as a disease, not in any nation. There are several ways to speed innovation to find and develop medicines and technologies that prolong healthy lifespan. But the easiest is also the simplest. Define aging as a disease. Nothing else needs to change. Researchers working on aging will compete on equal footing with researchers working to cure every other disease in the world. The science-based merits of grant proposals will dictate which research efforts are funded, and private investment will continue, as it should, to drive innovation and competition. Labs like mine, focused specifically on developing innovative therapies to treat, stop, and reverse aging, will no longer be rare. There will be one or more at every health science university in the world. And there should be, because there is no shortage of scientists lining up to enlist in this army. Right now, I and other researchers who study aging are being besieged by eager, experienced, and absolutely brilliant youths who want nothing more than to devote their lives to the fight to stop aging. For lab heads like me, it's a virtual buyer's market. There are far more people who want to work in aging than there are labs they can work in. What this means is that there are a lot of people who, despite being wicked smart and raring to tackle the aging problem, are having to work in other fields or other professions. This will soon change. The first nations to define aging as a disease, both in custom and on paper, will change the course of the future. The first places to provide large amounts of public funding to augment the fast-growing private investments in this field will prosper in kind. It will be their citizens who benefit first. Doctors will feel comfortable prescribing medicines, such as metformin, to their patients before they become irreversibly frail. Jobs will be created. Scientists and drug makers will flock to that country. Industries will thrive. Their national budget will see a significant return on investment. Their leaders' names will be in the history books. And the holders of the patents, the universities and the companies will have more money than they know what to do with. I'm proud to say that Australia is leading the charge to define aging as a treatable disease. I recently made a trip to Canberra to meet with Greg Hunt, the Minister for Health, and Deputy Secretary Professor John Skerritt of the Therapeutic Drug Authority, and about 15 of Australia's other top aging researchers. I learned that developing a drug for aging may be far easier in my native land than in the United States. While the United States expects evidence that a disease is cured or alleviated, in Australia it is possible for a drug to receive approval for, quote, influencing, inhibiting, or modifying a physiological process in persons, end quote. In the aging field, we know how to do that. Singapore and the United States are among the nations that are also seriously considering a regulatory shift. Whichever does so first will be making an historically important decision, one that will benefit itself first and foremost. There's a reason why the United States virtually owns the aerospace sector, exporting products worth more than $131 billion in 2017. Or more than the next three national exporters combined. First in flight isn't just a good slogan for North Carolina license plates. It's a statement about why being out front matters. Americans retain the pioneering spirit of their ancestors. Anything is possible. More than a century after the Wright brothers flew the first planes at Kitty Hawk, and after almost losing out to the French and British, the United States is still ahead in the flight game. It has the world's most powerful air force. It got to the moon first. And it has a big lead in the development of public and private initiatives to put people on Mars. But none of that will impact human history as much as the first nation to declare aging a disease. At a bare minimum, governments have a vested interest in making sure the innovations we develop to protect human life are used wisely and for our collective benefit. The time to talk about ethics and how personal privacy will be impacted by these coming technologies is now. For once the bottle is opened, it will be exceedingly hard to put the genie back. DNA-based technologies that enable the detection of specific pathogens, for example, could also be used to search for specific people. Technologies now exist to create humans that are stronger and longer lived. Will parents choose to give their children the best possible start? Will the United Nations outlaw the genetic improvement of citizens and military? To create a future worth living in, it won't be enough to simply fund research that lengthens and protects people's lives and ban its misuse. We must also ensure that everyone benefits together. It's time to insist on the right to be treated. The dentist looked bored. "Your teeth are fine," she told me as she peered into my mouth. "Just the normal wear and tear. I'll send the hygienist in for your cleaning, and we'll get you on your way." It seemed as though she were turning away before her fingers were even out of my mouth. "Doctor, if you can spare a moment," I said, "can you tell me what you mean by normal wear and tear?" "You're getting older. Your teeth are showing that," she said. "Your two front teeth are worn down. Totally normal. If you were a teenager, we would probably fix them, but..." "Well then," I said, "I'd like to have them fixed." Eventually, the dentist relented, although not before I told her what I did for a living and explained to her that I was hoping to use my teeth for a very long time to come. I assured her that I would be happy to pay for the procedure, even if my insurance wouldn't. Her resistance was understandable. When dentists look into the mouths of patients who are in their 40s and 50s, they have long been looking at teeth that are halfway done with their jobs. But that's no longer the case. Our teeth, like all of our other body parts, are going to have to last a lot longer now. My experience at the dentist was a microcosm of the way middle-aged people are treated in every facet of the healthcare system. When a doctor looks at a 50-year-old person right now, his or her goal is to keep the patient less sick, not to ensure that he or she will be healthy and happy for decades to come. Who among us over the age of 40 has not heard a doctor say the words, "Well, you're not 20 anymore"? There are two things that guide medical treatments more than anything else: age and economics. The first often limits what doctors are even willing to discuss in terms of treatment options, because they assume that people are supposed to slow down, begin dealing with a bit of pain, and gradually experience the degradation of various body parts and functions. The second dictates these discussions even more, because regardless of how much potential a procedure may have to improve a patient's life, it is pointless and even heartless to tell someone about care he or she can't afford. Indeed, our medical system is built on ageism. When we are young, we don't get treatments that could keep us healthy as we grow old. When we are old, we don't get the treatments that are routinely used on the young. This all has to change. The quality of our medical care should not be predicated on age or income. A 90-year-old and a 30-year-old should be treated with the same enthusiasm and support. There will be enough money to pay for this because of the trillions of dollars that won't have to be spent by insurance companies or the government, and hence ourselves, on treating the chronically ill. Everyone should be entitled to treatments and therapies that improve quality of life, no matter what the date on his or her birth certificate is. As we move toward a world in which the number of our birth years indicates less about us than ever, we will need to adjust the assumptions, rules, and laws that govern what medical treatments people can receive. Equitable access to medical care, no matter how long life may be, is a terrifying idea to many people, because it sounds awfully expensive. That's understandable, because as it stands, social medical programs across the globe are straining under the ever-increasing cost of treatment, especially treatments that are provided to those who are very sick, very old, and likely to get nothing more than a few extra years, if that, out of the deal. that's not what the future of medical care needs to look like. Right now, the overwhelming majority of the money we spend on medical care is spent fighting diseases. But when we're able to treat aging, we will be tackling the biggest driver of all disease. Effective longevity drugs will cost pennies on the dollar compared to the cost of treating the diseases they will prevent. In 2005, a study by Dana Goldman and his colleagues at RAND in Santa Monica put some numbers on this. They estimated the value that new discoveries would add to society and the cost to society to extend a human life by 1 year. The cost of an innovative medicine to prevent diabetes, $147,199. Of a cancer treatment, $498,809. Of a pacemaker, $1,403,740. Of an anti-aging compound that would extend healthy years by a decade, a mere $8,790. Goldman's numbers support an idea that should be common sense, that there is no cheaper way to address the healthcare crisis than to address aging at its core. But what if the drugs don't keep people healthy? What if they simply prolong life, like many cancer chemotherapy drugs, which are approved based on their ability to provide a longer life, not a higher quality of life? Society should debate whether longevity medicines that don't keep us healthier should ever be approved. If they were to be allowed, there would be even more elderly people with disease and disability and, according to Goldman, healthcare spending in 30 years' time would be 70% higher. Fortunately, the science suggests this nightmare scenario is not going to happen. When we have safe and effective drugs to slow aging, they will also extend our health spans. What will be left will be medical maintenance, which is exceptionally cheap, emergency medicine, which is costly but rare, and communicable diseases, which we'll be able to track, treat, and prevent with far greater efficiency and effectiveness. It's similar to making the switch from gasoline-powered cars that need oil, belts, tuning, and regular maintenance to electric cars that tell you occasionally to top up the windscreen washer fluid. Having lived in Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, three countries with an intertwined history, language, culture, and trade, I've found it interesting to see how similar they are in some ways and how different they are in others. One big difference is that most Australians and Britons rarely assume that their way of doing things is the best. Americans, however, often believe that their way of doing things is assuredly the best. I'm not saying the United States doesn't do a lot well and shouldn't continue to blaze its own path in many areas of domestic and global policy, but I've long been perplexed by the American resistance to studying what actually works elsewhere. In science, we call this experimentation, and it's what propels our civilization forward. The more experiments are conducted, the better informed we are, and some experiments work really well. Seeded as a prison colony, Australia is one of the least religious countries in the world, but when it comes to providing for its citizens, it is a city upon a hill. Like the United States, Australia has its problems: traffic snarls, a high cost of living, and strict rules aimed at saving lives, even if those rules often take the fun out of life. There is a statistic, though, of which Australians are increasingly proud. A 50-year-long experiment to protect and preserve every citizen, regardless of social position, education, or income. Deaths from car accidents and smoking are the lowest in the world, thanks to strict laws and hefty fines. Even before these laws passed, there was a bigger change afoot. In the mid-1970s, a universal healthcare system was enacted, one of the first ever, and life expectancy in Australia began to shoot up. Similar to the United States in the 2010s, the next government tried to limit the scope of that progressive reform, but ultimately failed. A controversial right-wing politician, Bronwyn Bishop, helped create an independent Australian Federal Department of Health and Ageing, which lasted from 2002 to 2013, with a budget of around $36 billion Australian dollars, focusing on health promotion, disease prevention, and services and caregivers for the aged. During this time, Australia continued on an upward trajectory, using its wealth to create more health and productivity in its workforce, and its health and productivity to create more wealth, a virtuous cycle of the highest moral order. Between 1970 and 2018, Australian men gained an additional 12 years of life. Their healthy life expectancy is 73 years, 10 years higher than the global average, thanks to a significant decline in the percentage of people suffering from disabling health conditions. The elderly in Australia are being less elderly, less of a burden, and much more productive than other nations. If you visit Australia, the difference between its fit, active elderly and those in the United States who are saddled with obesity, diabetes, and disability is noticeable. My father thought he was headed for the grave. Instead, he's most often headed to concerts or the mountains. He spends several nights a week eating out with friends. He's adept at computers and new high-tech gadgets, and was one of the first people in Australia to have a smart speaker with a virtual assistant at home. He's unbothered by international travel, so we get to see him frequently. He's gone back to work. Physically and mentally, he is at least 30 years younger than his mother was at his age. His remarkable health may or may not be due to the molecules he takes. The coming years of his life will be an indicator, whereas scientific proof will come only in the form of double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. But he is also helped by frequent exercise, access to excellent medical care, and a system that believes in disease prevention, not just late-stage treatment. He is a shining example of a new generation of Australians in their 70s and 80s who are not just living longer, but living far better than any of their forebears. In 2018, Australia ranked 7th on the Global Human Capital Index, a measure of the knowledge, skills, and health that people in a nation accumulate over their lives, just behind Singapore, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Finland, and Ireland. The United States ranked 24th. China ranked 25th. The trajectory for Australia is up, and the Aussies aren't looking back. Having seen what works, other, mostly European countries have adopted similar healthcare systems. Australia now has reciprocal agreements with the UK, Sweden, the Netherlands, Belgium, Finland, Italy, Ireland, New Zealand, Malta, Norway, and Slovenia, which means that citizens from those countries can receive the same medical care in Australia as they can at home, and vice versa. Imagine an entire world like that. Meanwhile, some countries are being left behind, and one in particular is moving backward. Thanks to the burgeoning addiction to calories and opioids, and a healthcare system that is inadequate, if not completely inaccessible, to one-third of its population, the United States recently experienced a decline in life expectancy for the first time since the early 1960s. That decline may soon exceed the decline in life expectancy caused by the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918. This is happening despite the fact that the United States spends 17% of its GDP on healthcare, nearly double that of Australia. I don't mean to disparage the country in which I live. It has been very generous to my family and me. But I am frustrated. Ever since I arrived in the country that actually put humans onto the moon, it has been a shock to see opportunities to help more people for less money wasted over and over again. The United States has been a leader in both public and private investment into life-saving medical research. And although it can be hard to track the origin of every drug in this increasingly interconnected world, by one estimate, 57% of all medications are developed in the United States. Other nations, especially those that don't invest as heavily in medical research, should be grateful to the United States for discovering and developing most of the drugs that ensure their increasingly long lives. In a just world, the citizens of the United States would be the greatest beneficiaries of the medical breakthroughs they subsidize and produce. They're not. Australians are, Britons are, as are the Swedes, the Dutch, the Irish, and the Slovenians. They're all benefiting in terms of lifespans and health spans because they have the sort of universal access to healthcare that 15% of registered Democrats and half of all Republicans in the United States have come to fear. That the average American lifespan is just 4 years shorter than Australia's belies the fact that in the poorest regions of the United States, citizens live a decade even shorter than that. As the Australian example proves, when everyone is living longer and healthier, everyone does better. So why isn't this a topic of discussion in the United States? Why aren't people charging Capitol Hill with protest signs and the proverbial pitchforks, demanding more investment, universal access to medicines, and the healthiest lifespan on the planet? As other countries enjoy increasingly longer, healthier lives, perhaps Americans will wake up and smell the disparity. But I suspect they won't. Though the World Health Organization ranks the United States at number 37, below Dominica, Morocco, and Costa Rica, and one up from Slovenia, it's still common to hear U.S. politicians say, without any justification, that the United States has the best healthcare system in the world, and millions of people believe it. The alternative to a universal right to be treated, regardless of age and regardless of the ability to pay, is a world in which rich people increasingly benefit from even longer and healthier lives than they already enjoy, while poor people suffer through short, disease-ridden existences. This is a terrible idea for rich and poor alike. My line of work has put me into contact with some of the wealthiest people in the world, who are understandably interested in learning the secrets of longer and healthier lives. I've yet to meet a single one who wishes to see such a divide come to pass. In that direction, after all, lie the seeds of revolution, and revolt seldom goes well for the ruling class. As the venture capitalist and very large yacht owner Nick Hanauer wrote in a memo to My Fellow Zillionaires in 2014, there is no example in human history where wealth accumulated like this and the pitchforks didn't eventually come out. You show me a highly unequal society, and I will show you a police state, or an uprising. There are no counterexamples. None. We will not be able to predict when, and it will be terrible for everybody, but especially for us. Hanauer's warning came before longevity genes were on most people's radar, and long before most people had so much as contemplated what significantly lengthened lifespans and health spans could do to the rich-poor divide. Universal access to technologies that prolong vitality won't fix every problem associated with income inequality, but it's a crucial start. We should be able to die whenever we want to. By cosmic standards, this region of the Milky Way isn't a horribly inhospitable place for life to evolve in. We're here, after all, and the outer edges of spiral galaxies like ours seem to hold reasonably good promise for a few life-sustaining planets to materialize, far better than the dwarf galaxies that are the most abundant type of star systems in the universe. The way the astronomer Pratica Dayal sees it, however, the most likely places for life to form and thrive in are the rarer, metal-rich giant elliptical galaxies, twice as big as the Milky Way and often much bigger, holding as many as 10 times the number of stars and perhaps 10,000 times as many habitable planets. By the way, if you're under the misconception that if we screw up this planet we can just travel to a new one, consider that the closest known habitable exoplanet is 12 light years away as the crow flies. That sounds close, but barring the discovery of a space wormhole or light sailing of tiny cargoes at near light speed, it would take at least 10,000 years to get a few humans there, which I've argued is another good reason to figure out how to extend human lifespan. The closest giant elliptical galaxy is MEFA-1, which is about 10 million light years away. We can assume that if explorers from MEFA-1 ever make the trip to visit us, they'll be from an exceptionally advanced society. I expect they'll have a few questions, for they will want to know how far we have advanced too. First, I believe, they'll be curious about the easy things. Have we figured out pi to a million decimal places? The speed of light? The fact that mass and energy are the same thing? Quantum entanglement? The age of the universe? Evolution? Next, they'll ask us about some of the harder stuff. Have we learned to use the resources available on our planet wisely? We'll get passing marks on that one, I suppose, as long as we don't mention lead pipes, nuclear bombs, and Furbies. Have we done so sustainably? Pass. Then they'll likely want to hear about what other worlds we visited. We sent 12 guys to Luna, we'll say. Where's that? They'll ask. We'll point to the big white orb in our night sky. They'll say. Just the men of your species? We'll nod, and they'll roll their 146 eyes. After that, they'll want to know about our lifespan. Have we figured out how to live far beyond the time given to us by evolution? We didn't know that was a thing worth studying until a few years ago. They'll offer a bit of overly enthusiastic encouragement, as a human adult might do for a baby who is learning to eat solid food. The next question will be a rather grave one. How do you die, they'll ask. And how we answer that question is going to be an important indicator of just how advanced we truly are. Right now, as my mother's death exemplified, the way most of us die is barbaric. We go through a long period of decline, and we've come up with ways to extend that period of pain, grief, confusion, and fear, so that we must experience even more pain, even more grief, even more confusion, and even more fear. The sorrow, sacrifice, and turmoil this creates for our families and friends are protracted and traumatic, so that when we finally pass on, it often comes as a relief to those who love us. The most popular means to the end, of course, are diseases, which can strike in the prime of life. Heart disease at 50, cancer at 55, stroke at 60, younger onset Alzheimer's at 65. Way too frequently, what is said at funerals is that someone left this life way too early. Or the diseases don't kill, and the fight to beat them back again and again is a decades-long exercise in suffering. These are terrible answers to the question of how we die. The answer we should strive for, just as much as we strive for prolonged vitality, is when we are ready, then quickly and painlessly. Fortunately, the science of longevity shows that the longer we make rodents live, the faster they tend to die. They still die of the same diseases, but perhaps because they are very old, and the animals are on the brink anyway, they tend to suffer for days rather than months, then keel over. This is not the only way we should meet our end, though. Physician-assisted suicide, death with dignity, elective euthanasia, whatever we call it, we need to end the patchwork of laws and customs that force people to travel great distances, often when they are already suffering in one way or many, to bring their lives to a peaceful end. These are the sorts of barriers that the eminent ecologist David Goodall faced in 2018 at the age of 104, when he was forced to leave his home in Australia, where physician-assisted suicide is illegal, and journey to a clinic in Switzerland, where it is lawful and safe. No one should have to choose between dying in a foreign land and committing a crime as his or her last act on Earth. Thus, no one with a sound mind who is over the age of 40, about the age at which one has paid back the initial societal investment in his or her education, should be denied the right to die on his or her own terms. And anyone at any age with a terminal diagnosis or painful chronic illness should have the same right. Yes, there should be rules. Certainly, there should be counseling involved and a waiting period. It should never be easy to take one's life on a whim rather than taking arms against a sea of troubles. If it were, I and many others would probably not have made it through our teenage years. But we should not presume to leverage guilt and shame upon the sane adults who wish to control the day of their final breath. Nearly every day, and often multiple times in a day, someone tells me that they have no interest in living to 100, let alone many decades longer. If I get to 100, just shoot me, they say. I think that 75 healthy years sounds about right, they say. I just can't imagine having to live with my husband for even longer than I already have to, one rather distinguished scientist once told me. That's fine. Indeed, there seems to be little appetite for the idea of living in perpetuity. I recently gave a talk to a general audience of about 100 people spread across ages 20 to 90, a good cross-section of the local community. The main donor to the Institute was late, so I had to fill in time. I grabbed the microphone and I did a little experiment. "How long do each of you want to live?" I asked. By a show of hands, a third said they'd be happy with 80 years. I told that group that they should all apologize to the audience members who were older than 80. That got a laugh. Another third indicated that they'd like to see 120. "That's a good goal," I said, "and probably not an unrealistic one." About a quarter wanted to make it to 150. "That's not a silly thing to dream about anymore," I said. Only a few people wanted to live forever. The numbers were similar at a recent dinner at Harvard for scientists who were studying aging. Very few of the attendees said they were gunning for immortality. I've talked to hundreds of people about this topic. Most people who want immortality are not afraid of death. They just love life. They love their family. They love their careers. They would love to see what the future holds. I'm not a fan of death either. It's not because I'm afraid of being dead. I can say this without reservation. On a plane, my wife Sandra clings to my arm at the first sign of turbulence, whereas my pulse doesn't change. I travel enough to have experienced mechanical troubles on planes more than a few times, so I know how I react when faced with possible death. If the plane goes down, I die. Letting go of that fear was one of the best things I ever did. Here's where things get really interesting. When I do this little survey and then tell the audience that they could retain their health no matter how many years they live, the numbers of those who say they'd like to live forever shoots way up. Almost everyone wants that. It turns out that most people aren't afraid of losing their lives. They are afraid of losing their humanity. And they should be. My wife's grandfather was sick for many years before he died in his early 70s. At that point, he'd been in a vegetative state for several years, a truly horrible fate. But he had a pacemaker, and so whenever his body would try to die, he'd be zapped back to life. Not back to health, mind you, back to life. There's a big difference. In my mind, there are few sins so egregious as extending life without health. This is important. It does not matter if we can extend lifespans if we cannot extend health spans to an equal extent. And so, if we're going to do the former, we have an absolute moral obligation to do the latter. Like most people, I don't want unlimited years, just ones filled with less sickness and more love. And for most of those I know who are engaged in this work, the fight against aging isn't about ending death. It's about prolonging healthy life and giving more people the chance to meet death on far better terms, indeed on their own terms, quickly and painlessly, when they are ready. Either by refusing the treatments and therapies that offer a prolonged healthy life, or accepting those interventions and then deciding to leave whenever the time is right, no one who has returned what they have been given should have to stay on this planet if he or she does not wish to do so. And we need to begin the process of developing the cultural, ethical, and legal principles that will allow that to happen. We must address consumption with innovation. The environmental writer and activist George Monbiot is among those who have observed that when it comes to the future health of our planet, people are overly preoccupied with the number of humans on Earth, while ignoring the fact that consumption bears twice as much responsibility for pressure on resources and ecosystems as population growth. Monbiot, who is on the far left, isn't right about everything, but he's certainly right about that. The problem isn't population, it is consumption. We know that humans can live healthily and quite happily while consuming far less than most people do in the developed world. But we don't know if they will. It is for this reason that among scientists who subscribe to the idea that our planet has an absolute limit of people it can sustain, those who have offered a generous estimate of the Earth's carrying capacity are those that assume that our species will be capable of making more from less, even perhaps as we increase the standard of living for billions of people. The more pessimistic predictors, meanwhile, generally assume a global tragedy of the commons in which we greedily consume ourselves to death at an all-you-can-eat buffet of natural resources.